This is Scott Richmond.
And Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM. Arnie Sherman, good morning.
Good morning, Scott. What a great Sunday morning.
How are you today? And who is our guest today on this lovely fall morning?
You know, it's a lovely fall morning and it's football season. I have to mention that we're in full gear. NFL, Canadian Football League. Yeah, our guest today is Caitlin Borgman, who's the recently installed executive director of Mountain Home Montana, which is one of three organizations in the state of Montana dedicated to providing shelter and support for single mothers and their children.
Sure.
And it's a great organization. Caitlin has had a long history in public interest work. She founded the Montana ACLU and served as its director for a number of years. She's a Yale graduate and a New York University Law School graduate, where she was the senior editor of the Law Review, which is a big deal.
Right, sure, definitely.
You know. So she has roots in Montana, but also roots in back where we love, New Jersey, New York area, and has come back to Montana 15, 16 years ago to continue her career here.
These are always our favorite types of interviews, Arnie, because we get to meet someone from our neck of the woods, but we get to ask them the questions. What brought them here? What motivated
them
to come
back
here?
Right.
What kind of food have they been?
Yeah, no, but all seriously. All the important things.
Right.
No, but it's, here's somebody who grew up in Missoula, gets into Yale, which is not a normal occurrence for most Missoula,
residents,
goes to a law school, gets involved in teaching at City College, City University in New York, teaching in a law school there, having a career in public interest work, and then comes back to Montana to bring that kind of expertise and that kind of worldly understanding of issues and problems and concerns back into Missoula, and then just recently took over Mountain Montana Home as an executive director after it's been around for 27 years.
So she's taken a big step from ACLU to Mountain Home Montana.
Right.
Our guest is Caitlin Borgman. Back after these words. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Caitlin Borgman, executive director of Mountain Home Montana.
Caitlin, it's great to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to spend the morning finding out about all the great things that you're doing. You're new to the organization, right? You're mm-hmm. the executive director since the beginning of 2025.
Yes.
And as I did my homework, I realized there was a lot of activities happening. You even have a campus now
yes.
for the organization. So give us a little backdrop for our listeners. Give us a little genesis of the organization.
Right. Mountain Home Montana is a nonprofit that is celebrating our 25th anniversary this year of serving families in Montana. It was founded by Laura Snyder, who was a labor and delivery nurse who saw young moms giving birth to kids and not having any place to go. She founded the organization in 1998, and then in 2000, a family in Montana, a woman named Bonnie Hamilton, donated her family home, which was on South, the corner, just west of the corner of South and Reserve. We started with housing three young moms there and their kids. And then over time, the organization has grown both in terms of being able to house more families, but also serving many more moms and their kids who are just living in the community, who aren't necessarily living at Mountain Home. So it's not just a residential facility.
Sure.
We provide wraparound care to young moms and their kids. Our motto is where moms can discover their strengths and children thrive. So it's really this two-generational approach. Two families who definitely come from backgrounds of poverty, mental health issues, often backgrounds of trauma or abuse, substance use disorders, and provide them all of the different kinds of support that they need to be able to go out and make safe and stable lives for themselves and their kids.
Do you also serve, it just came into my head at the moment, single fathers with kids?
We do provide some services for fathers as well. For example, our parenting classes are mm-hmm. open to both the moms and the dads. But our primary focus is on young moms. Typically, they're the ones that have custody of their kids or need to be able to have a place to live or to get services for themselves and their children. So that's the main focus.
And how do your clients find their way to you? What's the referral system look like?
Yeah. So one of the things that's been so great about this job, I've been in it for 8 months, coming really more from a background of policy and legislation and sort of a little bit more removed from direct mm-hmm. services, is the network of care of organizations providing different types of care to families in need in Missoula. And we partner with 100 different community organizations.
We have no shortage of community organizations.
No, we really don't. And so those organizations, you know, we all know what each other does and everyone has a little bit of a different niche. So we get referrals from those organizations. People can also, you know, sign up to be on our waiting lists on our website or, you know, obtain our community-based services from our website. So it comes from all different kinds of places.
Do you get crisis referrals, like a police department picking up a woman with a child and has no place to take them and they try to reach out to you?
Possibly, but one thing that's a little bit different about Mountain Home is we're not an emergency shelter. So there are places like that, YWCA, mm-hmm. for example. We provide longer-term care, so the moms who are in our residential program, for example, will typically stay with us for 12 to 18 months. And so it's a longer term model where they're able to stay with us for long enough to really get the support services that they need to go and be able to live independently. It's not sort of an emergency. They need a safe place to stay tonight, mm-hmm. but won't necessarily be here tomorrow night or two nights from now.
So on any given day in little old Missoula, Montana, how many families are you you're working with? What's your client base look like?
Yeah, over the course of a year, we serve about 100 moms and their kids. And that includes our residential moms and then also, you know, nearly 100 families that are living in the community.
And what's the residential capacity of the organization now?
So in our old facility on South, we just moved to a new facility, so I'll share more about that. But in the old facility, we had space for 6 families in the group home, which is a communal living kind of setting. And then we had 5 residential or transitional apartments where families could sort of prepare for living independently. They had a lease, very low rent, but sort of, you know, learning to live independently in that sense. In the new facility, we don't have the transitional apartments anymore just because of the way the facility is set up, but we have now capacity for up to 20 families in the group home.
Wow.
And if we renovate an additional space that we have, we'll eventually have room for up to 26 families.
And there really are only a couple of other programs like this in the entire state of Montana. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's really just one that's similar, different, provides some different levels of service in terms of substance use especially. But that's Florence Crittenton in Helena. But yeah, not many.
No.
Especially considering the need.
Absolutely. And how would you describe the need at this point in time? Is the need growing? Is it, you know, steady? Is it influenced by, you know, the economic environment that we're living in, or, you know, drug epidemic? All those things?
All of the above. Yeah. And as you can imagine, it is growing, right? Because we know that affordable housing has become such an issue in Missoula and elsewhere across Montana. And so that's just pricing families out, and especially young moms that maybe haven't even gone to or finished college or have not yet gotten a steady job. So
is there an extensive waiting list?
Yes, we have a waiting list of usually 30 plus families waiting just for the residential.
And what are the criteria?
Services.
If someone is applying, to, you know, to use your residential mm-hmm. facility? What are the criteria you look at to make a determination of whether they're eligible or not?
Yeah, so we're pretty flexible because we don't have a specific, like a substance use facility, for example, designated substance use facility. Mm-hmm. We can take moms from a lot of different backgrounds and different ages. Our age range for the residential part of our program is ages 16 to 24. But it's usually it's either a pregnant or parenting young woman. And they usually have one, maybe two kids at that point. And we have the capacity to house them and their children together. Mm. And then 90% of our clients that come in have a mental health, disabling mental health illness. 90% of them have some kind of substance use disorder. We're not a licensed substance use disorder facility.
Right.
And so if clients need a certain level of care, then we can't take them, right? So we're always striking this balance of not wanting to just take the easy cases, right? Because those clients can often, with some support, find other housing or services. But also then, you know, there's a certain level that we're just not equipped to be able to handle. And so it's always one of those balancing.
How large a staff do you have?
We have almost 50 staff currently. Yeah. And we're obviously going to be growing because we're in this big new facility.
Do you mind sharing your operating budget? Like what does it take to run?
Yeah. Last year, our operating budget was about $2.25 million.
Wow.
And we're going to need to grow that to 5 million plus as we reach capacity. It'll probably be closer, I would say, to 6 to 7 million by the time we're fully occupying the buildings that we have.
And where does the money come from?
Great question. So we are funded by three main sources. Last year, about half of our budget came from federal grants. About a quarter of our budget came from Medicaid billing for the services that we offer. We have a mental health center, licensed mental health center that bills Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a quarter of our funding came from private foundations and individuals.
Right.
And we're looking to grow those two smaller pieces of the pie.
Because the federal stuff is not growing.
Correct. Correct. We're probably pretty much maxed out on what we can get from federal grants.
It sounds like that's why they brought you on, right? Is to help grow to the next level. What attracted you to this position?
Well, exactly that. You know, I love a challenge. And first of all, obviously the mission. So my background, although it hasn't been in direct services, has had a big focus on women's empowerment. And so for me, this was really just a particular version of that mission and that passion that I have. And then I just was so impressed with how gutsy this organization is, like how much they have done in 25 years to grow, to be providing this really wraparound model of care that is so unique and so needed in the Missoula area. And then the ambition to have done a capital campaign that allowed them to purchase this facility. It's up in the South Hills on off of 23rd Avenue.
Right.
Formerly the Hillside, it was Hillside Manor, I think it was called, was a nursing home or rehabilitation facility. Just the vision to want to be able to grow even bigger and provide more services. Obviously, there's such a need for it. And, I think, as you know, nonprofits can often be very conservative, you know, understandably so, right? They're stewards of public money and private donations. And so it's easy to want to be really cautious. And I was just excited that Mountain Home had this, this real ambition to make as big of an impact as possible. And I wanted to support them with that. And yes, I did have experience with private fundraising in particular, not with the direct services so much billing, but the but the fundraising is really something that I actually love to do and had done in my previous work at ACLU.
Well, the fundraising helps you tell the story, and it's you have a good story to tell, and you're enthusiastic about it, and you've raised money, you've done public interest work, you've done advocacy, but now you're running an operation.
Yes.
So what do you notice, or what part of this is, new to you, more challenging, a stretch, something that you have to learn more about, considering the other things were more policy-oriented and you didn't have a facility where people were living under your care?
Yeah, exactly. Well, all of that is new, right? So the billing, fee-for-services, like that's new for me to have earned income as opposed to just existing based on donations. And then definitely the owning a facility, right? I mean, it's just like, oh, the roof is leaking, or the plumbing is clogged, or there's always something happening, right? And and it's, that feels like a really big new kind of thing to wrap my arms around, and having to budget for all of that. I mean, we own and lease vehicles so that we can transport clients. I mean, there's just, food service.
It's a big operation.
You got to cook for them, clean for them. You got a whole big new family.
Yes, exactly.
I remember when I ran halfway houses early in my career, we got from the state of Ohio $13 a day for each of our clients. And that wasn't very much.
That's not a lot of money.
No.
Do you feel like, where you are in your career, like this is meant to be something like this, where this is like the culmination of everything that's kind of led you to this place? You're back home in Missoula. You're working in an organization that's on a real growth trajectory. Mm-hmm. It's not for profit. It's serving the community. Talk a little bit about the feelings about, being a part of something like this.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I came back home to Montana, I had been involved in the ACLU for a long time from the board perspective, but not and staff at the National ACLU, but not as a in an executive director role ever. So I had a long history of working with nonprofits.
And that was back in New York? Where was that?
Yes,
in Washington?
In New York.
In New York.
Yeah.
And how long were you there for?
In New York.
New York, yeah.
25 years.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah.
In Manhattan?
Yes.
You
well,
lived in
working
Manhattan?
In Manhattan. And then eventually when I taught at CUNY Law School, I was in Long Island and Long Island City in Queens.
And where did you live?
We lived in Manhattan until our first baby was 4 months old or something, and then we were just like crowding out our one bedroom apartment with a stroller,
like,
and all the things, and so we moved to Montclair, New Jersey, which is kind of where a lot of it's so either
like
Brooklyn
Manhattan
or
Light.
Montclair, New Jersey.
Right.
Yeah,
Montclair.
Exactly. Yeah. That's it.
I'm from. We lived in Summit. So.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Montclair.
Yeah.
Summit.
Great town.
Yes.
Weehawken.
But Montclair is like, it's the suburbs, but it's got a lot of culture.
It did. A
right?
lot of culture, a lot of restaurants. Yes, 100%.
When did you come back here?
2015.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've been here 10 years. I'm from New Jersey. He's from New York.
Yeah.
Sorry, we do have to ask you, just as a little aside here. Mm-hmm. You're gone. I know you were coming back seeing your family here.
Yes.
But you were gone
yes.
for 25 years.
Yeah.
How was Missoula in 2015 compared to when you left?
Well, as you said, I came back all the time, right? So my parents were still here. I came back and eventually, with my husband John and eventually with our kids every summer and winter for vacation. So it still always felt like home to me. And it actually very much felt like home to our kids as well.
Well, that's good.
So we, we saw the change happen gradually. But yeah, I mean, Missoula... It still has a little bit of that, it had a very earthy, crunchy vibe, right, in the 70s when I was growing up here. The Good Food Store has been around forever. The Trailhead, right, they've moved locations. But a lot of these businesses are still here, which is lovely. Oh, absolutely. But obviously we've got, better dining now, options and more concerts, the Kettle House Amphitheater. I mean,
well,
we didn't have these things.
Thing is, I just had someone visit who was 16 years old, came to visit, never been to Missoula.
Right.
Just stunned. He said, where are all the cowboy hats? We used to go downtown to eat, and half the men were wearing cowboy hats. Even in the 90s.
Right. It was cowboy hats and cowboy boots or Birkenstocks.
Right.
It was kind of like,
right.
Yeah.
Now the both of them have kind of moved out in a way.
A little bit, yeah.
So it's a little bit different environment now, and it's in some ways just because of change in technology and change in, you know, transportation,
right.
And this new amazing airport that we have.
Right.
It feels like a, you know, more connected place than an isolated place.
Well, it does. And it's funny because I was thinking about this when I went to college. So I went to Yale. I took the Greyhound bus literally to get to Yale. 3 days sitting on a Greyhound bus, and no one knew anyone from
Montana. Was that your first time in New Haven?
Yes.
Really?
Oh, definitely. I never saw
the
school before.
You never saw it?
No. I mean, people who don't know, like, so I
very frontiers
started
woman.
Yale at in 1983. I mean, people that I knew anyway did not go flying to visit colleges. I mean,
right.
That was just like not something you could afford or anyone did, right? You just looked at brochures, really.
Right.
And then, I mean, we didn't even have like computer tours, you know, video tours or anything like that. So yeah, that was absolutely the first time. And I remember my father, who was a philosophy professor for many years at UM, one of his former students lived there and picked me up and like brought me to the campus. And no one knew Montana. No
well,
one
never
knew.
Met
at all.
They thought it was in the Midwest. You know, they were like, "Oh, you're the first person I've ever met from Montana."
Yeah.
And that would just never happen now, right? With Yellowstone, like everyone, Montana just has this like.
Well, it started like with the river
everyone...
runs through it, right?
Then right.
True.
Started paying
yes,
attention.
That's true.
But you're absolutely right. So a lot of people never met anybody from Montana.
How can
right.
people
has
not
no
know
idea
the
where
geography
is?
Of the United States?
They don't know it. They don't have
the Midwest.
Idea.
I know.
It's the Pacific.
It's one of those M states. You know?
Right.
I have no idea where it is. It's somewhere near Nebraska.
Did you have a Barron's book? A Barron's book for colleges. That's what I
yes.
remember
yeah.
having.
Yes.
And that's what
yes.
you read.
That's true.
Right?
Right.
Well, geez. So what did you think of the pizza when you got to New Haven? Did you go to Pep's?
Well, you know, so we had Zamorino's pizza here, which was like the big, thick, bready crust. And the, like all the dripping top. And
right.
it's delicious. But very different. Like I had to learn, like, oh, this thin crust, like that's
New York pizza,
New York,
Kaylin?
New Haven pizza.
Yes, yeah, which is delicious. Also, yeah.
This Absolutely. Is one of our favorite topics that Arnie and I talk about is food.
Right. I remember going and getting
Wonderful.
New Haven pizza.
And yeah, Sally's and Pepe's.
Yeah, all those places.
Mm-hmm. Oh, let's do a quick ID. Our guest is Kaylin Borgman. She is the executive director of Mountain Home Montana. We're talking pizza now, but we were talking. The growth trajectory of Mountain Home Montana.
So you come on board. Had the decision already been made to get this new campus facility that was the...
Yes, yes. It had already been purchased
right.
and the renovation was underway.
But money still had to be raised?
Yeah. We do still have about $1.5 million left to finish all of the final bills for the construction.
It yeah. always is more, right? It's never less.
It is. And especially when you're renovating an old facility, you just
you
find
don't know
things.
What you're going to
yeah.
find.
Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
Gosh.
Yeah. That's... Absolutely.
So you have ambitious plans.
Yes. Well, yeah. And, you know, it was pretty much set that, I mean, we're going to grow, right? That was the
well,
whole
and
reason
you, and
to
you now have
purchase
the
this facility.
You have the blueprint in place. You have
exactly.
You have this. How many yeah. square feet in the facility?
32,000.
That's
and
big.
Our old facility had 17,000. And then the house has an additional 7,000. So we've more than doubled our previous
big.
Square footage. Mm-hmm.
That's bigger than the UM campus was for 20 or 25 years.
Tell us a little. You had mentioned your dad.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about him.
He taught philosophy for 50 years at University of Montana.
Yes.
Yep. He grew up in Germany and then came to the United States as a young man. He sailed on a ship called the Arosa Sky. He washed dishes on the ship to get himself to New York.
What was
and
his
then
name?
Albert Borgman.
Albert, I thought I read that.
And then took a bus or a train to Texas and went to the University of Texas in Austin, and then eventually met my mom at the University of Illinois.
And tell us about your mom.
And she started working. She was a stay-at-home mom until I was in high school, I think. And
uh-huh.
then she started working at UM and eventually
yep.
worked her way up to become the affirmative action director at University mm-hmm. of Montana for many years.
My gosh. What a cool household to grow up in.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously feel very connected to the University of Montana campus.
Of
I mean,
course.
I grew up riding my bike around the campus and... Yeah, my parents have both passed away since, but you know, a lot of people still know them because they lived in the community for so many years.
50 they were legendary.
They it legendary sounds like couple, it. Well, someone sure. who teaches for 50, is there a big mm-hmm. philosophy program still at the university?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think, so. I mean, what a great mm-hmm. liberal arts school it is.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So growing up in Missoula, growing up on campus.
Mm-hmm. You went to high school at Hellgate?
Yes.
Of course.
So when you were ready to go to college, we're about the same age. So what was the, you obviously, you went to some great, to a great school. What was the deciding factor? Why Yale? Why, you know, what other choices were there for you?
Well,
I have a feeling there were other choices.
This sounds funny to say, but like in those days, we didn't know other schools. Like I remember finding out about Dartmouth. Like my sister applied to Dartmouth. And it was like, that name seemed so weird to me. I never heard of it. It was like Harvard and Yale you heard about, right? And my sister went to Harvard and I wanted to do something different. And it just by luck of the draw, I got waitlisted at Harvard and I got into Yale. So I went to Yale. And in those days, I have to say, like people say this a lot in our generation, right, Scott? But like, I could have never gotten into Yale today, right?
Really?
I don't think so. There were so many fewer people applying from Montana, right? So it was like, geographical diversity.
Right. Here's somebody from Montana.
I mean, I don't want to sell myself short, but you know, like today.
But you know how they did it. They were saying, well,
they
have pins in the map, right? We haven't had anybody from Montana.
Exactly.
Let's get some. The person has all the right credentials.
Yeah.
I mean, they never met anybody from Hellgate High School, I could imagine.
Right, exactly. Oh, that was
my sons
right.
went to Hellgate. Right.
I'm just saying, she goes to Yale and they say, absolutely. Which preparatory school did you go to?
Exactly.
Hellgate.
The Hellgate Academy.
Yeah, okay, great. Which school was it really?
Yes, that got a lot of chuckles for sure. Yeah. So that's kind of what it was, right? I learned later what a wide variety of schools there are across this whole country. But it was just kind of, yeah.
Your sister went to Dartmouth?
No, she went to Harvard.
She went to Harvard, okay. Yeah. And then, I'm sorry, and then do you have any other sibs?
Yeah, and then my younger sister went to Brown. And that was another one where we were like, what is this school?
But
then,
in all the IQ.
Did you play any? Right. Were there any sports athletics as part of your curriculum or growing up? Did you play tennis, golf?
I ran track? Cross country and track. Nice. And I played soccer and then I skied downhill skiing, racing at Snowball.
Did you do any of that at Yale?
Yes, I just skiing. I did the ski club there, which it was a club sport. But
there's so many great Yale alumni that are in the public's eye these days. I won't mention.
But always have been. I mean, you know, Yale and Princeton; those are the two that always used to compete. Harvard was on the side a little because of the Boston connection, but Princeton and Yale always seemed to. In football or in, you know, rowing or whatever. Mm-hmm. It was
crew.
Columbia was like, you know, on the side. Brown no one knew about. But, you know, the other two were, you know.
Didn't you go to the Harvard of the Midwest?
No. I did not go to the Harvard of the Midwest. So I want to, we're going to get back to, you know, your job and what's going on here. But you're living in New York for 25 years. You're coming here for the summer. But your main residence is in New York. You have all the culture. Mm-hmm. You have all the theater, entertainment, you know, the three airports and, you know, all that kind of stuff going on. You're rearing your family, and then you decide to, with your husband, with John, pick everybody up and move them all to Montana.
Well, that, not quite, because by the time we decided to move and the ACLU of Montana job had opened up, which was kind of the perfect job for me to come and back to Montana for, right? By that time, our younger kid, our son Griffin, had moved to Colorado to go to college. And so we had our kids had flown the nest and it was the perfect time to move because they didn't need to, you know, they were already basically out of
the family discussion on moving, it was only the two of you, you and John, making that decision.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's good.
Yeah,
how many kiddos do you have?
We have two.
And what are they doing?
So our daughter, Elena, is a OB-GYN resident at University of Washington in Seattle.
Nice.
And she wants to come back to Missoula and practice gynecology here. And then our son Griffin is moved here from Colorado last year with his partner, and is actually living in the house that I grew up in, which is really fun.
Nice.
And does accounting and finance work for Namchak, the nonprofit meditation.
Cool. Oh, that's Pritzker's.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So this is what an interesting family.
Well, yeah, what an interesting family.
Story, your dad, you know,
not your
mom.
Average Missoulian.
No, you know, John has his own story. We talked to him a little bit when he was on the show.
Yes.
A few months ago when we talked about the Innocence Project.
Right.
But we can't stay focused. You know, we're ADD. We have to start.
You see how we go
where
here.
You live and your background. But let's get back. So you got this new campus. You know, it's sort of like build it and they will come. Now you got a lot more space. You have these buildings. You know, it's driven by money. You have a waiting list. The more money you have, the more people you can serve. So what's your thought on where you're going to go from here in terms of building the financial base to run the kind of program that you envision?
Right. Well, like I said before, I think it's two things. One, there is a huge opportunity for fundraising. There are donors who have given loyally to Mountain Home for many years. But we didn't have really what we would call a major gifts program, dedicated major gifts program. Our development director, Kelsey Severson, is amazing at doing the federal grants and, you know, brought in a million.
And that's hard
to find
somebody.
It brings in annually about $1.5 million from that. And we need to continue to do that as long as that funding is available. But we have now hired another development person, our senior director of philanthropy, Allison Struckall, who is heading up a major gifts program, which we didn't really, you know, we had one person. One person can't do both all of that federal grants work and design and run a whole major gifts program. So that's the new part. And I think that holds a lot of potential. A lot of behavioral health organizations don't rely a lot on fundraising because they do a lot of building Medicaid can be most or even almost all of the income. So that's another opportunity for us to grow a little bit. But I really like having the diversity of funds and wanting to just balance out that federal grant funding with a little bit more of the other two sources to keep us a little bit more nimble.
All the eggs in that one basket, particularly given the unpredictability of the federal government these days.
Are there any statewide grants you could tap into as well?
Yeah, we get some state and local grants, and then some of the federal money comes through the state. So those are sort of pass-through grants that we get.
Tell us some stories, if you will, not naming names, of course, but some stories that our audience can relate to relative to helping families. Like, what's like an example of someone who came in, and what was the circumstances, and what's the duration of time that they stay with you, and what's that experience like?
Yeah. So one of the things that's so inspiring about Mountain Home is not just the mission and the staff, but the clients, right?
Right.
Their resilience is so incredible. And the statistics of what happens after 1 year of services, that they are able to get jobs, right? You know, coming in with 90% of them with serious mental health issues and 90% of them having stable mental health when they leave, over 90% of them having stable housing, their kids, staying safe and together with their children. They come from backgrounds of, you know, they may have had an abusive partner or an abusive family member.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them get kicked out of the home when their family finds out that they're pregnant. So they may start with us as a pregnant teenager or very young mom. And then once they have their kid, then we provide the support for both generations. And that's the really key thing about Mountain Home, is we're trying to break these cycles of poverty where the child will then grow up with, you know, trusting relationships and a stable home. And
you follow them after they leave, right? You follow...
Sometimes, I mean, well, yeah.
Or are there handoffs to different organizations? Like, I don't mean to say handoffs, but really, like, who helps keep the continuity?
So it depends, right? The whole purpose of Mountain Home is to get moms to build stable lives for themselves and their kids. So ultimately, right? They're no longer relying so much on social services as they were during the time that they're with us. Mm-hmm. That's the goal, right? So, I mean, I'll give you an example of one mom who came back to us. She'd had like a couple years of college, I think, and then there was a break and she moved to Missoula. I can't remember if she was moving back home or just moved to Missoula, but re-enrolled at UM, got her undergraduate degree, and then got accepted into the program for an MBA, and is now enrolled in for a graduate degree. She's our first mom to go straight from earning an undergraduate degree into a graduate program.
So if, given the continuum of care, if she has a child that needs to be taken care of while she's going to school, do you provide that service?
Yeah. So one of the things we do provide is trauma-informed child care. And that is, we're one of the first organizations to provide specifically trauma-informed child care. So we have early child care teachers in our program, and we have ratios that are fewer children per staff member in order to qualify as a trauma-informed facility. And so our moms can access childcare through us, but sometimes, you know, they get it elsewhere as well. So it's all just a matter of helping moms. If we don't provide the services or for whatever reason our services aren't the best match for them, then we help them with connections to the community. So in addition to the services that we provide, which is mental health, therapy, case management for both moms and kids, the child care, and then the residential, we have a supportive education and employment program, which provides them with all of these connections to job trainings and parenting classes and, the whole array of services that they would need, some of which we provide and a lot of which are provided in the community. But the goal is, you know, that mom gets out, you know, gets a job, has an apartment where she can pay the rent, her kid's now in school, right? She's just thriving in the community. And that's the goal. So then they spread their wings, right? And we do, you know, our staff will run into clients that, you know, were children at Mountain Home with their young mom and are now adults thriving in the community. So, but, you know, for the most part, right, it's like you want them to fly the nest and be successful.
Sure.
And so, you know, over time, like we shouldn't need to be providing services anymore is the ideal, right?
Sure.
It's so much, and usually the case as well.
It's so much more challenging and overwhelming for a young woman in those circumstances. I mean, if you laid out a case history, here's a 16 or 17-year-old boy and girl, maybe, you know, about the same age. The girl gets pregnant. The parents intervene, pull the guy out of the situation completely. She's left on her own now. Her parents maybe have thrown her out or disassociated himself, or they've labeled her or stigmatized her. Mm-hmm. And now she has to worry about being a 17-year-old mother and then supporting herself independently.
Right.
It's just, guys don't have to deal with that.
Right. 100%. And we know, right, that moms who are in poverty when they're raising their kids, those kids have such a higher percentage than of themselves living in poverty as adults. Right. And that's where we want to break that cycle. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I think one of the things to me that's so admirable about Mountain Home is that it sees the strength of these moms, right? And they talk about how, like, at Mountain Home, you know, the staff looks at me and sees opportunity, not you know, like a failure or, you know, whatever messages they've been sent.
They're not cataloging you and categorizing you and putting you in a box.
Right.
You're a failed person because you're in this situation.
Exactly.
Caitlin, let's go back a little. We're going to jump around a little bit. Go back to your family life and your growing up. What do you think prepared you for this? Like, you know, sounds like you had a wonderful upbringing.
Yeah. But
tell us about, is that, do you think that right there was, you know, the seeds of kind of your, you know, your desire to kind of serve the community and serve in these cool, these really very progressive and cool roles?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, my parents were very much about giving back and, you know, being really strong members of the community. So I think that was just sort of instilled in me. And then I did have this amazingly supportive family. We didn't have extended family in Missoula, but my parents were just a total solid network of support for me, right? And so that's what enabled me to go off, you know, to the East Coast for college and to thrive in my school and career. And so the idea of having, like you mentioned, Arnie, like having to do that on your own, to me, is so daunting and so unfair too, right? There, to,
oh, right, and, right. And I think that the odds are so stacked against you at that point. I mean, it's just impossible.
And for no reason, right? It's just like that. I think that was another thing that was really instilled in me was this sense of fairness. You know, my kind of story of becoming a lawyer and eventually just a social justice advocate was reading To Kill a Mockingbird when I was in sixth grade and reading about the Scopes Monkey Trial and just like suddenly realizing like about structural
inequality
and equity and really wanting to do something about it and realizing that the law was a vehicle for that. But ultimately it was really about, I always said, I want to help people. I also had so like I said, my father grew up in Germany and his mother, who was born in 1911, was a feminist and she represented the German Alliance of Women at UNESCO, and she would travel to, you know, disadvantaged countries to support women, and so that you know was pretty unusual for her generation.
Particularly by the time
even
she hit her 20s, totally. It was right in the middle of the Nazi, you know, buildup in Germany.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And so. And she was just this very loving, like dignified person, very much like cared about not just women's equality, but equality and equity in general. And she was a big role model for me.
Did she come to the United States? Did she immigrate to the United States?
No, she stayed in Germany. And actually, my dad's whole family, most of them stayed there. So we would.
What do your siblings do?
Visit them occasionally.
Now, what do your sisters do?
My younger sister is retired. She was, she did creative writing and is a beautiful poet. And my older sister is a pediatric hospitalist in the Boston area.
Wow. How nice. The sisters. The sisters from Missoula. Arnie.
Yes.
You started your career in a similar fashion, serving families that are young men.
I did a little bit of opposite. I worked in halfway houses for a while and then ran runaway shelters. And then I did advocacy and policy work afterwards.
Interesting.
After I had my hands on, sort of in the day-to-day operations. And then after the policy work, I went back and ran community-based youth services for a long time I metamorphosized into a college professor and international, you know, business development person. But for me, there was a huge difference. And I enjoyed the work running community-based youth services. We had the largest network of foster homes in the United States in Chicago. We had like 80 foster homes that we would have kids. And then as a result of that, we did advocacy work and rewrote the juvenile code to take status offenders out of court jurisdiction. So it mixed together eventually at one point. But the world of running an organization because you want to help people quickly metamorphosizes into doing Medicare billing, you know, and fundraising and, you know, human resources, hiring and firing people and keeping places staffed up and dealing with all these
all
other things that.
That
you never were trained to do. I didn't go to school.
Which
to
leads
how to
me
do
to, I have a question for Caitlin about that. When we've asked this of other guests, how has technology and AI impacted your job? In the positive?
Right. Yeah, I think largely positive. I mean, I can't even imagine the kind of documentation that you know, in the papers and files. And I mean, we have some paper files, but I mean, when I think about what it used to be like, where everything was hard copy and memos and like mimeographs
of
things.
You had a room full of file cabinets.
Yeah, it was, oh my gosh.
But it's beyond word processing and numbers crunching.
Yes.
It's everything.
Like storage of everything and like, yeah.
Isn't that incredible?
Yes, it is. And even just like writing something, right? Like if you just need a rough draft of something, you can throw a bunch of stuff into ChatGPT and it'll... give you a really nice first draft to work on, or it'll like organize things for you. Yeah, I know.
It saves time.
I was saying the other day, we used to have either a PR firm, or you had an assistant, or you had a research person, and you'd say, we need a page of, you know, copy or something, and mm-hmm. 2 days later, you get it back.
Yeah.
You can go to... I go to April. That's who I call my ChatGPT. I need a 1,500 words that describes this thing, and they, and I want it to be like this and this and this, and have a lot of adjectives and blah 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 blah, and then boop 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 boop. Phew,
exactly. And I mean, there's a lot of things. You know, obviously this is like a black hole we could go into.
Right.
There's a lot of things to be concerned about with AI.
Of course.
But for strapped nonprofits, right? You don't have the money to hire someone else. So it's not like you're not displacing
that all someone. Disappeared. All that middle layer of, you don't have money for that anymore.
Yeah, you don't have it anyway, right? It's not like you would be otherwise hiring for this job. So it does add capacity in that sense. I mean, I do think though, email. Right. Different messaging apps, those kind of things, that is extremely time consuming. And it's always a battle to figure out how much time are we really saving versus like the time we're spending slogging through all that stuff.
Right.
And I mean, my father was a philosophy professor of technology. So.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he was very wary of like the impacts of technology lives.
That's a good place to leave it. Let's take a quick break. Pay some bills here. Our guest is Caitlin Borgman. She is the executive director of Mountain Home Montana. Back after these words. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Caitlin Borgman.
Let's refocus on this one point because we started talking about it. My career went more of a traditional way. You work in human services and you run agencies and then you do policy work. You started out doing policy and now you're doing direct service and running an organization. So tell me how that resonates in your life and how that fits together with, you know, the way you thought you would be at this point.
Yeah, I think if you had asked me way back when, I would have predicted it more of a path like yours, Arnie.
Right.
And I think I just stumbled into this because I was in law school and I ended up having a summer job at the ACLU, National ACLU. That was a policy role. And I just kind of fell into that. But I think it worked out really well for me because when I worked at ACLU of Montana, then I learned kind of this management role that I had not had before, and then and did that for 8.5 years. And then I took a year and a half off. My father had passed away, and I thought, oh, I'll just do some consulting now. And that was like a little sabbatical period where I did a lot of leadership training and reading and advising clients. And so I came into this job just feeling like so much, I had so many more tools for, like you said, these things that you don't get trained to do when you're just
nobody trains you to do half of what you have to do every single day.
No.
Sure.
So I feel really lucky to have had that background coming into it and not sort of having to like learn it on the job.
So let me ask you this. For our listeners, those that maybe has a potential client or client family for you, or those that want to contribute to the organization, you know, or just want to find out more about it or visit your new campus, how do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so all of that information is available on our website, mountainhomemt.org. And they can both find ways to seek services on the website and also donations. And obviously, financial donations are the most helpful for us as a nonprofit. That said, we do occasionally have opportunities for volunteers to come help with various things. And we post notices of those on our social media. So we're on Instagram and
Facebook. And what about other donations, like clothes or other furniture or any of those sorts of things?
We were taking those for several years. We have a boutique where the moms can, quote unquote, shop, you know, for free items that they might need. At this point, we're so full that we've paused our donations. And we certainly recommend that people go to the other secret seconds at YWCA or...
Right. That's one good donation thing about warehouse our community.
There are a lot of
very
places
generous
to,
in making those kinds of donations.
Yeah, so we're pretty good on that at the moment, and just putting a pause on the donations.
Good, that's very good.
Well, that hour went by very, very fast. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure,
Caitlin Borgman. This is your life, and it looks like you're smiling and enjoying it, and looking forward to each and every day.
Absolutely.
So thank you for being with us today.
Great. All right, Arnold. I'll see you next Sunday.
Next Sunday, Scott. Take care.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO.